Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Oliver Kay, senior football writer for The Athletic and the author of Forever Young, the story of Adrian Doherty, football's lost genius.
Ollie, I wonder if you could start by giving us a primer, like a précis of Adrian's life, just as we get started. Of course, we'll go into it in more depth throughout the course of this chat, but for now, it'd be great, I think, and helpful for people who don't know about Adrian to get a quick précis of his mm-hmm. life.
Adrian was born in Strabane, in County Tyrone, in 1973. He joined Manchester United in 1989 as a 16-year-old, and in the words of Ryan Giggs, as one of the most exciting, talented kids of his age group in Britain. He might even have said Europe, I can't remember, but there's no doubt from speaking to everybody I've spoken to for the book that Adrian was an extreme talent. He was a right winger, pace, trickery, courage, aggression, 2 feet. Everybody absolutely raves about his football talent. Ryan Giggs said he was incredible. Gary Neville said he was out of this world. So in terms of his football talent, it's all those kind of adjectives that he was an extreme talent at the age of 16. He was on the verge of making his Manchester United debut in his first year as an apprentice. He travelled with the team to a game at Southampton and was due to be on the bench, but Danny Wallace passed the fitness test at the last minute. So he was extremely talented. Ryan Giggs was 6 months younger than him and in the year below. But people said, well, you didn't talk about Ryan Wilson as it was then.
Yeah.
You talked about Doherty and Wilson being the two extreme talents at Manchester United at the time. And Gary Neville said that he remembers going along to a Youth Cup game against Sheffield Wednesday in probably early 1990, which was actually at Old Trafford. And he'd seen Ryan Wilson, now Ryan Giggs, before, and he'd seen various other lads, and he's just said he was absolutely blown away by the sheer talent of Adrian, and he just ended up thinking, well, you know, I've just signed schoolboy terms with Manchester United as a 14-year-old, but if that's the level, what I'm seeing from Ryan and from Adrian Doherty, if that's the level, then none of the rest of us have got a chance.
It's interesting you said it, because I interviewed Mickey Gray for one of these episodes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he said to me almost exactly the same words as you just said there. He said, when I first saw Adrian and Ryan, I thought, if this is the level, I'm not going to be good enough.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, he didn't actually play for Man United in the end, but he obviously had a great career. But so that gives you a perspective of how head and shoulders above the rest they were. So it is fair to really, in that context, compare Adrian with Ryan Giggs at that stage.
I think everybody at the time was comparing them.
Yeah.
And I think it seemed, the more I sort of stumbled across the story and ended up digging very deep and speaking to loads of people, and it was like they were kind of, I mean, they were both incredibly young to be even training with the first team at that time. They were, you know, just coming up to 17, and then just past the 17th birthdays when they were training with the first team on a daily basis.
Mm.
And it seemed like at one stage one of them would be ahead and would be playing lots of games to the reserves and travelling with the first team. And then, you know, because you get, you know, with young players, they would get peaks and troughs and in and out of form. And at other times, the other one would be ahead. The reason this book came about, or the reason I stumbled across the story at least, was because I was doing, I was going to be doing an article in early 2011 about Ryan Giggs's, it was coming up to the 20th anniversary of his debut at Manchester United. And I thought, well, rather than do the kind of typical, oh, what a great player Ryan Giggs has been for the last 20 years, I thought I would sort of go back to 1991 and speak to a load of people who were with him in the youth team, which everybody thinks, well, oh yeah, the youth team, that was it, that was him and Gary Neville, David Beckham, Paul Scholes, etc. But it wasn't, because
they're a bit younger.
They were the school year below him,
yeah.
And he was already playing up a year, as was Adrian. So they were playing age 16 with people who were sort of in the under 19s, as it would be now, or they're playing with the reserves or A team. So they were already playing in the FA Youth Cup in 1989-90. So I was speaking to people from that team about Ryan Giggs, and I would say to them, look, so Ryan, was he just head and shoulders above everybody, even at that age? And one of them, Alan Tong, who is a guy who didn't make it at United, played for Exeter a few times, career ended by injury. Now does a podcast, actually.
Mm.
And he said, well, do you know the name Adrian Doherty? And I said, look, because I'm just an absolute nerd, it did trigger something in my mind from 20 years earlier, where I would have seen his name in probably the Rothmans football yearbook. And, you know, I would have known the names of Alan Tong and Kieran Toll and Adrian Doherty and Lee Costa. And so I said, well, I did know the name. What's the story there? And he said, well, Doc was as good as Ryan Giggs at 16. Incredible. And he got injured, drifted out of football, and he died at a young age. And I said, I was like, what? How do you mean? How did he die? And Alan said, I'm not quite sure the details, but it was something about a canal in Holland. And I just thought, what on earth is this? There's a player at Manchester United who was as talented as Ryan Giggs, who died having had their, you know, having been unable to fulfil their potential. That would have set alarm bells ringing for me and make me think, what's this story that I don't know? So I Googled him when I got off the phone to Alan, and there was basically nothing on the internet. There was a couple of threads on, one of the Manchester United fan forums saying, who remembers Adrian Doherty? And one person would say, oh, he was amazing, but he died, it was tragic. And the only other thing was a sort of online tribute page, which had been set up by one of his coaches in Derry, a guy called Matt Bradley, who basically had, you know, just wrote again, you know, the same thing. He was extremely talented, one of the most talented players I've ever seen in sort of 50 years in football or whatever. And he said, tragically died at the age of 26. He had these two newspaper clippings on the site. One was saying, boy wonder standing by, 16-year-old described as the best thing since George Best, on the verge of his debut for Manchester United. And the other one from 10 years later in June 2000 was saying, you know, tributes paid to the tragic soccer jam or something like that. And it was, and I just remember just looking at these two things and saying, well, what happened in that 10 years? Why do I not know this story? And what happened? And I want to know more about this. So I was ringing other people for this Ryan Giggs piece anyway. But by after that, I started asking them about Adrian too. So I spoke to Adrian, Eric Harrison, who was, of course, the Manchester United youth team coach at that time, and Mark Bosnich. And Mark Bosnich was saying, you know, exactly the same as Alan Tong had said. Oh, incredible player. I mean, it just obsessed me, really, trying to find out what had happened to this.
It's a fascinating situation because the only time I'm obviously, we're sort of roughly the same age. I'm perhaps a touch younger, but certainly not much younger. And I'm someone who's, I mean, you described yourself as a football nerd there. I was exactly the same as a kid. And I'd never ever heard of him. And I called up some of my friends who I've, you know, spent most of my life watching football, talking about football with. None of them had heard of him. Mm. The only time I'd ever heard of him is when I saw your book be reviewed somewhere, and I thought, oh, that sounds good, I'll get that. And I got it. And then obviously the story became fascinating. When I Googled him, all I could find was quite a short BBC Northern Ireland tribute to him with a short interview with his father, a TV kind of thing. Mm. And that's it. And there's a couple of clips of him playing for Northern Ireland schoolboys and I think Derry City or something
Yeah, that's right.
And I guess that kind of leads me on to my next question, which is, obviously I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, but I think it is a pertinent question to answer in the circumstances. How much of his reputation is improved by his absence, by his fact that this is not a guy who went on and played for Sheffield United and Wolves kind of these big clubs, but slightly smaller in profile. This is a guy who didn't have a career at all.
No.
So how much do you think that aids the legend, if you like?
I would say, I mean, if he had had a sort of low level career, as I think he still could have done after his injury, had he felt up to it in terms of, I mean, he would have been nothing like the same player because his knee was severely damaged. But had he wanted to have some kind of career, I'm sure he could have done.
Mm.
But had he done that, then I'm sure the legend might have not been, you know, maybe perceptions of him as an extraordinarily talented 17-year-old would have been tempered by what he didn't achieve in his career. But I think, somebody said that to me after the book came out. They said, do you think people are just kind of exaggerating how good he was because he died?
Mm.
And I said, well, absolutely not, because, I mean, for one thing, I mean, it's something like Gary Neville. Gary Neville wouldn't rave about a guy who was, I mean, I thought Gary Neville, Ryan Giggs, people like that, I thought they might not even
remember
him or really particularly want to talk about him. But the way Gary Neville spoke about him, it was so extreme. There was something he likened to, something he did was almost Messi-like, and something else he did was almost David Silver-like. And Gary Neville isn't one for gushing excessive praise, I don't think, and particularly about players who didn't make it. You only need to go back and see what people said about him at the time, which included Alex Ferguson saying, oh, he's got so much talent, we think he's going to make it here, which is not something you would expect Alex Ferguson to say about a 16-year-old. I think, having spoken to so many people, I think the feeling is that had he made his debut, he would have absolutely relished it and would have not frozen on that stage. He would have made a big impact. We could then get on to a question of, would he have had a Ryan Giggs-like career?
Mm.
I don't think he would have done at all. I don't think he... I think the thing that really fascinated me more than his talent was his personality, which was so different to the typical footballer. I don't think he was ever going to have a long Ryan Giggs type career at the highest level. I think he would have, say, all had been well and he hadn't got injured and done his cruciate when he did, I think he would have made his debut the next week. He would probably have torn it up for the Manchester United first team for a few weeks. He would probably then have done something daft off the pitch and then got in trouble with Alex Ferguson, got dropped, forced his way back in again, and probably had you know, a year or two of being amazing, and then for reasons that which we can probably go into about his personality, I think I don't think he would have stuck around.
I do want to talk about his character. Yeah. We'll definitely come on to that, but give people a quick sort of synopsis about what happened that curtailed his career physically.
Yeah, he, as I said, he was very much pushing on the door of the, or knocking on the door of the first team, early 1991, which was when Giggs and Darren Ferguson made their debut in a game against Everton. United at the time had a huge fixture pile up because they were in the League Cup, the European Cup Winners' Cup. They were struggling to fill the bench for the European games. There's no doubt he would have been on the bench for some of those games. There's no doubt he was in the manager's mind for games against, I think, Sheffield United and Everton, which was the one where Giggs made his debut. And a week before that game against Everton, he injured his knee in an A-team game. And although the injury was reckoned to be not incredibly serious at the time, it was, he never recovered from it. It was ligament damage, and it was sort of scanned eventually about, you know, several months later.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, you're quite critical of how it was approached and how he wasn't immediately diagnosed and looked after in that way, presumably because he was an A-team or reserve team player at that point, although he was a big prospect, and there was not a huge amount of medical staff that we're used to having in the game now, right?
Yeah, it was at the time, it was, you know, the club had a physio, and there was a doctor who worked away from the club that the club used as, you know, as their doctor. So it was, yeah, a fairly primitive approach compared to now. And because it wasn't a game, he hadn't been stretched off or anything like that, or hadn't been carried off, it was not reckoned to be a particularly serious injury. I would struggle to go through specifics now because it was written about 4 years ago, but it was, if you look through the medical notes, and some of them are repeated, it sounds like the injury wasn't regarded as serious for the first few weeks, and then they eventually, because it didn't heal, they eventually looked into it, and it was found to be a damage to the cruciate ligament. And even at that point, you know, whereas now you would have a cruciate ligament reconstruction almost the next day or very quickly once the swelling had gone down. This was August, and I don't think he had the surgery until he'd had a massive relapse, basically, in the December. So he eventually returned to training, still seemingly carrying this injury. And in his first game back, which was a B-team game against Marine or, you know, one of the local teams, he just sort of broke down straight away. And this, you know, this time it was immediately recognised as being an extremely serious injury. And the family look back on that and just think, well, what was going on, and why wasn't that diagnosed quicker? Why wasn't it?
Well, they've entrusted him to their care because he's a kid from across the Irish Sea. They're not with him. And it's probably important to make that clear because, I mean, things have changed perhaps quite a lot now, but back then, the kids would come across. I mean, George Best famously did it and got homesick and wanted to go home. Yeah. They live in digs. They're kind of expected to fit in and really become almost men grown at a young age. And because he was such a sensitive character, they probably were concerned, not just because he was injured, but because he was out there without anyone to support him.
Yeah, and I think that's a big issue because I think even before his injury, he didn't really like the sort of professional football club environment. He went over as a 16-year-old, as I said, and he'd only just turned 16. So he's from a small town on the Irish border, moving to a big city, age 16, Catholic lad, wet behind the ears in some ways. There's some details about how wet behind the ears he was in the book. And he basically, he found the whole environment around the training ground, he found it sort of very strict on one hand in terms of the training and all the jobs that they had to do. And on the other hand, he found it, you know, completely chaotic in terms of some of the sort of prank culture and, you know, stuff that went on in
digs. It's very alpha male culture as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. And you know, football clubs, probably less so now, but in that era, you get a lot of people talking about sort of initiations and you know, apprentices being bullied and all this kind of thing. And some of the apprentices or the lads that were in that age group that I spoke to said it was just horrific what, you know, what the older lads would would do to us. And I suppose Paul Scholes, who said, oh, it was unspeakable, some of what went on. And I said, well, what do you mean by unspeakable? And he said, well, you know, literally, I can't speak about it. But, you know, you could never get away with that now. And that whole culture around it has changed now, in that players aren't even sort of allowed to pump up balls or clean boots now. So it's kind of gone the other way. But at that time, there was this sort of rite of passage type thing where once the first year apprentices had become second year apprentices, or they'd become first year professionals, they would generally, and not just at Manchester United, but I'm sure at most clubs, they would generally sort of make the first year apprentices' life a misery. And, you know, if the reserve team dressing room wasn't cleaned out properly, or the somebody's boots weren't dirty or weren't clean, or the balls weren't pumped up properly, you know, they'd be punished. And punishments would be anything from, you know, getting locked in the sauna for however long, or getting put in a washing machine, which, you know, that sounds, God, well, it's not a washing machine, a tumble dryer. Yeah, there's a slight difference.
Yeah, yeah.
But neither particularly pleasant.
No.
Or getting, you know, just being held as balls got pelted at you from across a.
There's talk of boot polish and kids being locked in sports bags and all
exactly,
sorts.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So it's all that kind of thing. He had found the whole football club environment a real culture shock, because he thought he was going along there to play football, and it was going to be fun, and
and his parents were assured by the decision makers at the club that he would be well looked after as well. I mean, you make that clear in the book as well.
Yeah,
and they just didn't have a clue what was going on, or they were turning a blind eye to it.
No, I think the club generally didn't know what was going on. I think, you know, a lot is talked about how Alex Ferguson was on top of everything and had eyes everywhere. And I think, well, he did in certain ways, but I think, you know, from everything that a lot of those players talk about from that age, they were, you know, it was quite riotous in the apprentices' dressing room until somebody said, quick, you know, the boss is coming, or Eric Harrison's coming, or you know, Nobby Stiles is coming. It would be chaos at times, and things would be going on, and players would be having to run around the car park naked or in the cold or whatever. So on one hand, Alex Ferguson had an incredible grip on a lot of what was going on, but, you know, he couldn't have a grip on everything. And you know, things like the drinking culture, which it was said that, you know, history says that he booted out Norman Whiteside and Paul McGrath in the summer of 1989, and the drinking culture sort of stopped overnight. Well, you know, it didn't. I think Roy Keane talks about how the drinking culture was still there when he arrived 4 years later. But I think a lot of the young players were dragged into a drinking culture at the club that existed, and sometimes they would be punished heavily for going out and for turning up to training hungover or whatever. But it would be impossible for a manager, even Alex Ferguson, to have a real grip.
To be omnipotent, omniscient, yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, he was effectively managing probably, I mean, look, the numbers aren't the same as now, but his staff would have been so much smaller than it was in later years. So
you talk about the fact that it's changed now, and obviously you're much closer to football clubs than I am, but I think my opinion is that it has changed as far as the working conditions and the manner of employment across the board in the UK over the years has changed, as you'd expect, because generationally things do change. But I still do think that it's a very alpha male environment. You spend an hour or two in a training ground or at a football club among players and staff. It's still very alpha male, very kind of dominantly like that. I'm not going to say aggressive, but quite, you have to really puff your chest out and be confident to achieve there, clearly. Now, Adrian wasn't that type of character based on your book. And clearly he had a lot of bad luck around the injury to his knee and how it was looked after. But I wonder if you think that it would have been possible for a kid of that character to succeed at a football club at that level anyway, just regardless of ability, and whether it would be a place where a kid of that character could flourish now as well.
Well, he was flourishing on the pitch.
But there's a difference, isn't there, when you go through to become a senior pro and have a strong career. And you've already said yourself that you didn't think he would have a a career like Ryan Giggs did.
But that's partly because of his personality and because he sort of regarded football as a, you know, something he was really good at. I mean, when he was 14, 15, he was obsessed with being the best footballer he could be. But by the time he moved over to Manchester and he was playing, you know, he was training day in, day out, he wasn't really enjoying it massively, partly, I'm sure, because of the dressing room environment, partly because the training was, you know, very strict. It wasn't
as fun.
Express yourself, this is going to be fun. Partly because the jobs, you know, that they all had to do.
A bit of homesickness as well, probably.
And homesickness and not enjoying it at the digs. So I think from various points of view, he found it a pretty bleak existence at times in terms of the, you know, the challenges of being a professional footballer, and then going back to the digs and living with these lads who, you know, some of whom he got on with, some of them he didn't, and there just being no real escape from football 24/7, and a lot of the other lads being sort of a lot more serious on one hand, but a lot less fun in another. You know,
you talk about him locking himself in his own room, just playing his guitar for his
playing
own.
Playing his guitar, and you know, the guitar thing, the musical side is the thing that probably made me think, God, this really is an amazing story, because he was on the verge of Manchester United's first team, age 16, 17, and he was going out in the evenings into Manchester with a guitar, just playing in bars.
And, you know, busking as well.
Busking, and he would on Saturday afternoons, they had sort of complimentary tickets at Old Trafford, you know, the youth team players, they had the complimentary tickets, and he would wait outside the ground and give his tickets away to people, and he'd go into town and go busking instead. Now, admittedly, around that time, Manchester United probably weren't really worth watching, but he would literally go busking outside the Arndale Centre in Manchester on a Saturday afternoon, not particularly to get, you know, a little bit of extra pocket money on top of his £29.50 YTS, but just because that it was an escape, and it was, he didn't want to be sitting in Old Trafford watching the first team among these lads who were sort of thinking about football constantly. Mm. He wanted to play music, so he'd be sort of murdering Bob Dylan songs and singing out loud, and he didn't have the greatest singing voice, although he did take lessons and got better. But he loved playing the guitar, and he would wrote his own songs, wrote his own poems, and just became utterly obsessed with music and poetry and philosophy, and was just reading about all of that, you know, not just sort of in a kind of very introductory level, you know, reading something about, you know, Bluffer's Guide to Freud or whatever. He was going very, very deep into very, very deep subjects, sort of studying theology and things like that, and transcendentalism and meditation, and the way he sort of committed to that kind of thing, that sort of learning away from the pitch, and it was all self-taught. And the music, which was all self-taught, I think probably tells you that he was became more interested in that kind of thing than the football.
Yeah, no, I feel when I spend time interviewing players, both current players and sort of ex-pros, I always find them interesting. I always find their kind of their processes and their life interesting, and what they've achieved and how they've achieved it. But I'm always struck by the idea that particularly at a young age, they have to take quite a lot of boring decisions. They have to kind of, unless they're exceptionally good, and even then I would argue now that you probably can't, even if you're brilliantly talented, they're expected to make adult decisions as quite young people, and they kind of have to always make the boring choice, because to be single-minded enough to have a career, you kind of have to do that. And Adrian clearly, whether he knew it or not, wasn't capable of doing that. Despite the fact that he had an injury as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's, look, I think probably staying in his room certain nights playing the guitar was a boring choice compared to going out.
It's better for him than going out on the Raz.
As a complete contrast, some people might say the ultimate contrast. I've just done a book with James Milner, who talks a lot about those sacrifices that he just decided age 16, right? Well, I'm not going to drink. I'm going to pursue my football ambitions.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm not bothered about that. I'll forget about that. Constantly making those decisions where you absolutely put football at the forefront of everything. It's, you know, sometimes at the expense of family, booking himself into a hotel before home games, even when they don't have to, just because he wants his own routine. Mm. Now, Adrian would be probably the polar opposite of that, in that he was a spontaneous, disorganized, laid back, and maybe his sort of unique outlook on life would have served him well in terms of handling the pressures that came of being an overnight star if that had happened. But it's I think he would have been somebody who would have had an amazing impact in probably the short term, might have played 10, 20, 50, 100, 200 games for United or maybe elsewhere, but he because of the injury we will never know.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
I don't know if this was your intention in the book, but when I read it, I came away from it thinking that football clubs should have a responsibility to cater for different personality types. Mm. And I'm not talking about people who are driven or ambitious or not. I mean, you know, you can work with people who are hugely ambitious and hugely hardworking, but they have very different personality types. And your book, like I said, I don't know if it was your intention, but your book made me feel that certainly back then, only one type of individual could become a professional footballer at the top level. And I wonder what you think about that and whether you think that's changed.
I think you had to have a real kind of hardness and resilience to get through the apprenticeship, never mind.
Yeah.
Particularly,
but do you think they should cater for other personality types?
Well,
make more of an effort.
It's an interesting one, because if you talk about that, so I've talked about a little bit about the sort of initiation culture and the sort of difficult things that went on in the dressing room and homesickness, and a lot of people would respond to that by saying, well, look, if you're getting homesick, how can you expect to be strong enough to perform in front of huge crowds and cope with the highs and lows of football? You know, if you can't cope with being humiliated in front of your teammates in the dressing room, or you know, how can you be, you know, how can you be expected to be tough enough to be a footballer? And I do get that argument, but I think people kind of slightly miss the point, because when a lot of those stories about those initiations and things like that are told, and that prank culture, which a lot of the players that I've spoken to from that era just found unbearable, humiliating, upsetting, and it's not just United. Really, you know, I've heard worse at other clubs. But those stories are always told by people like David Beckham, Gary Neville, Robbie Savage, talk about them in their autobiographies. And they always come to the conclusion that, well, looking back now, it was horrible, but it made me tougher. It made me stronger. Now, it alone doesn't break people, but if that kind of thing, if that environment that they were in at the time caused other incredibly talented players to struggle to fulfill their potential, or made it hard for them to feel settled in a football club environment, and if it made them feel, God, I can't stand going into training every day, then that shouldn't really be looked back as some great kind of rites of passage thing that was a case of, well, you sink or swim with where you got this. This will sort out the men from the boys. I know of other players, and look, Adrian isn't around, tragically, to be able to answer these questions. So I don't know how he found that. Whether it was a small factor in him not enjoying life as an apprentice at United, or a big factor, but I know from other people who were with him at that time felt that just made the whole thing a misery. Yeah, you could say, well, you clearly weren't cut out to be a footballer then, but that's not a test of football ability. That's something different. That's a test of, whether you're willing to be humiliated in front of your teammates at the age of 16. And a lot of people wouldn't be. I would expect a lot of current footballers would struggle with that. And I think that kind of thing has rightly been sort of eradicated from the game.
Presumably, when you were writing this book, you felt like you really got to know Adrian as much as you could.
Yeah.
So I wonder if it was at times, particularly in light of what happened to him, it's quite a difficult book to write, because it's sad, of course, when anyone dies, but a young person of such talent, it always feels instinctively like such a tragedy more than it would anyway. So I wonder if you felt that upon writing the book, there were times when it was particularly difficult to do so.
I found it it was quite an emotionally draining at times, because I'd be, one of the things with it is that I sort of started off with nothing with the book. It's not like doing a biography of somebody who either is alive or there's a lot written about.
It's a great body of work, kind of thing.
The way you could kind of go consulting archive footage and archive material, etc. So I was basically sort of digging through every area of his life, and only 4 years of that were in the professional football environment. So there were 16 years before that, and what was it, 7 years after that. So it was a lot of the conversations I had were with his friends and with his family, and so they were telling me details about him which with the sort of level of intimacy that you wouldn't normally get when talking about a footballer. And they would talk about, he ended up, after football, he ended up sort of working in a chocolate factory in Preston, which sort of living in a kind of bedsit in complete obscurity. This is like a month after leaving Manchester United, and was just sort of playing working in a factory and playing the guitar in these sort of acoustic clubs, and reveling in the anonymity, never telling anybody that he was a Manchester United footballer. Then he went to Galway and was there for
what? Just a waiter, didn't he? There
was it
a waiter or barman?
He worked in a hotel. He had various jobs, but just a succession of sort of low paid jobs, really, just to sort of keep a roof above his head. And people would be telling me about, he was just living in this sort of little squalid little flat somewhere that was quite damp and cold, and the heating didn't work. And you just think, God, this is a kid who had everything. Ryan Giggs, who's his teammate, would be playing in the Champions League and would be all over the front pages, all over the back pages, and people like David Beckham, who were a couple of years below, but probably didn't have the same profile as he did at age 17, were superstars suddenly. And he was, this kid who'd been so talented because of an injury and various other things. He was living in complete obscurity. I think the obscurity suited him in some ways.
But the juxtaposition is very stark, isn't it?
The juxtaposition is totally stark. And it was striking to me that he never seemed to talk about football with a lot of his friends. You know, there were people who read the book and got in touch with me saying, I knew that guy.
Oh, right.
I never knew he was a footballer.
Football player, you know, right.
I used to drink with him most weeks in this bar in Galway. I never knew he played football. I knew him for 4 years. And that is not normal, is it?
No.
There's a story about him in his final year at United. His brother, who was studying in Manchester, met up with a friend of Adrian's, and Adrian's friend was convinced that he was a rat catcher. You know, worked for the, you know, pest control, and that's just what Adrian had said. Just,
right,
you know, the kind of sort of joke he would say. He didn't want to be now, even when he was absolutely tearing up for the Man United youth teams and A team.
He didn't want to be defined by it.
He didn't want to be defined. He wanted to. He never wanted to talk about football when he was out.
Right.
He never wanted to. You know, if people, you know, his mates would come over and say, "Oh, what's Brian Robson like? Oh, nice guy. Give me a pair of boots." But he'd never be that.
Yeah.
He'd never regale them with these stories about different characters or about. He would never talk excitedly or fondly about matches he'd played or anything like that. And that's one of the things that really came across when I was speaking to hours with some of his friends, and they were talking about what he was like and how he felt. What did he say about life at Manchester United? He said, well, he barely talked
nothing
about it. And you can probably read your, you know, jump to your own conclusions about that. But one of his mates gave me a letter which he'd sent in his first few weeks at United. And he was saying, oh, this isn't great. It's tough. The training's really hard. Some of the ideas they have are really stupid, and you know, we're having to work all the hours. And then one of his other mates said, look, one of the things he really struggled with was the sort of regimented, uniform nature of things, where you'd have to wear a certain, you know, you'd have to be wear a blazer and tie for turning up for matches, and you'd be expected to have your regulation kit bag and stuff, and he'd turn up with his odd shoes, or he'd turn up with his kit in a plastic bag and hair all over the place, and he was that kind of guy, and that's probably the way I would have been if I'd been a footballer. Yeah. But he struggled with that side of things, and he was kind of constantly getting told off for that kind of things because he didn't really see the point of, you know, why should I get my hair cut a certain way? Mm. And at one point he sort of grew his hair almost like a Mark Hughes style perm, but like a Bob Dylan type perm. And apparently that was, that didn't go down terribly well, is him turning up for pre-season with this sort of shaggy haircut. And so he said, kind of go for a crew cut instead then. So one of his teammates from then just said, Ferguson always liked your kind of short back and sides footballer who would be, you know, low maintenance, would always look the part when they turned up. Look, obviously Ferguson wanted a lot more than that, but that was a sort of one of the basic requirements. And so Adrian turning up for, you know, the League Cup final with shirt hanging out, hair down to his shoulders, and you know, I think Ferguson, it wouldn't have been a good fit, and yet Ferguson absolutely sort of indulged him as a talent because he thought he was such an extreme talent, and probably made allowances for him in the early days because he thought, well, this kid
can't afford not to. Yeah,
he needs to be handled differently, and then once the injury came, I think, you know, he ceased to get that kind of same level of indulgence. And I think Adrian's family would feel that he was sort of treated as somebody who was expendable and wasn't important.
Finally, Ollie, I wonder why this story is so compelling. Compelling enough, obviously, for you to write it and for me to be fascinated by it when I read it. And I've not ever really forgotten it, even though I read it a few years ago, and clearly lots of other people have felt the same. What is it about the story, other than the fact that it's exceptionally written, of course? what is it about the story you think that's really struck with people? In what way does it speak to them, do you think?
I think the story of unfulfilled talent is...
I think that's a very British thing.
Is, I don't know.
Because we love an underdog, right?
Yeah.
Or is that too simplistic?
And I think he was an underdog in various ways. I mean, coming from Strabane, I don't know whether another professional footballer had made it from Strabane at that stage. It's a lovely little town, but it's been very hard hit in the Troubles. It's been, you know, it's not somewhere that's had great investment in it. Mm. So he's from this Irish backwater, if I can say backwater. I think people in Strabane would probably smile at the phrase backwater. Mm. I hope they would, sorry. and it would be, and extreme talent, and he was brought up in the Troubles, and there are these sort of amazing stories about him kind of, you know, fraternizing with the local soldiers, and Adrian, you can't do that, that type of thing. And yet he was, and then from there into Manchester, which was, you know, a very exciting era, a very kind of nostalgic era, not just at Manchester United because things were changing so fast, but in Manchester with the music scene, etc. And he was probably into different music scenes to everybody else, but he was there at a very exciting time. And I think the idea of a kid who is so talented at football yet doesn't really love it in the same way that a lot of his teammates do, and has a completely different personality and is more of a kind of bohemian personality and is happier. You know, there's a quote from Ferguson where he said, you know, the boy with the most amazing football skill who was happiest with his guitar and his books. Mm. Now that, I think if you were making up a story about, you know, if you were writing a fictional story about a footballer who maybe didn't quite fit in, or, you know, you would say, okay, well, he had an extreme talent. Mm. What else would you have? You'd probably have him at Manchester United. Mm. You'd probably say he was from Ireland because there's a whole George Best thing going on.
Yeah.
You'd say he was a winger. You'd say that in terms of, you know, if you tried to create a different personality for him, you'd say he was you'd be a devout Catholic and he'd be into music and poetry. I think if you were making a story up, you couldn't make a better... If you were trying to make a character and plant them into sort of almost that sort of class of 92 era that was different to everybody else, you couldn't create a better personality or character than Adrian Doughty really was. And his story is one of sort of sliding doors in some ways. And the, you know, there's the thing with Ryan Giggs where one of them went on to absolute greatness and the other one went to, you know, he never played for Manchester United in the end because of the injury, and just played a handful of games for Derry City and then just gave up on football and settled for a life of obscurity, playing his music and writing his poems. And I just find that whole narrative, which, you know, narrative makes it sound like it's a fictional story. It's not. This is the thing. It's a true story of a guy who was just as talented as anybody as a footballer, but didn't have the luck and was probably in the wrong place at the wrong time, or the right place at the wrong time. And I just found it. Look, I'm not saying my book is amazing, but I do think it's the most amazing story. And that's why I wanted to write the book. Of all the footballers I've ever written about and interviewed and so on, I don't think any footballer's personality has grabbed me. And any footballer's story has grabbed me in the same way that Adrian Doughty's has. So if you were going to write a biography of Lionel Messi or Cristiano Ronaldo or, you know, Harry Kane or Wayne Rooney, you know, Wayne Rooney's probably a more multi-layered, interesting personality than the other three that I mentioned. But I think you'd be sort of repeating yourself a lot of the time in terms of what kind of personality they were. Whereas Adrian just seemed to be this absolutely multi-layered, endlessly interesting personality who had this most fascinating story right to the tragic end.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.